Okay, ladies and gentlemen, please take your seats. We are going to start the second panel of our conference, entitled Shaping an Agenda for Renewed Partnership, Common Interest in Europe and Beyond. I took the title of this panel as a point of departure, as general umbrella under which I decided to shape tailored very particular questions to each of the panelists. And we have indeed a very good line behind this table. Let me introduce to you Professor Adam Daniel Rotfeld, the former Minister of Foreign Affairs of Poland, the head of the very famous Stockholm-based think tank working on peace and security, CIPRI, a man on a member of various communities, associations, and advisory groups. Quite recently, a member of the group of the Weizmann, working on a new strategic concept for NATO under the leadership of Madeleine Albright. I would like to welcome Dr. Andrzej Olechowski, another Polish former foreign minister, and also in the past Minister of Finance in Poland. So he experienced of the life of a good and bad guy. I mean, good guys, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, and the bad guys, the Minister of Finance. Thank you very much, sir, for being with us. I would like to introduce to you, Stephen Flanagan, one of the most inspiring strategic brains of today in this country. We have been following his articles, papers, books in Europe permanently. I'm looking forward for his inspiring thoughts. Last but not least, I would like to introduce Kari Lig, Director of International Center for Defense Studies in Estonia. Thank you very much for being with us. And additionally, as an introduction, I would like to mention the following thing. We, behind this table, have two authors of this famous summer a letter to the administration. Adam Daniel Rotfeld and Kari Lig. Even more interestingly is that there is Andrzej Olechowski who didn't sign in this letter. So we will have an opportunity to learn both attitudes, those who signed the letter and those who didn't. As I said, I decided to tailor a very specific question to each of the panelists. I'm going to distribute the floor in the following order. First, I would like to ask Stephen Flanagan to speak, then Adam Daniel Rotfeld, then Kari Lig, and Andrzej Olechowski is going to speak as the fourth one. I'm not going to make a general introduction for this panel, but I would like to say a little bit more words about each of question I'm going to ask. So the question for Stephen Flanagan is the following. The challenges we face in transatlantic relations, particularly with NATO, particularly in the relations between the EU and the United States, are very well known. We have held during this first panel and during the speeches Phil Goldman and Zbigniew Brzeziński very long list of these challenges. The question is, however, how to build consensus around the means to tackle them. That's an important thing we should. Consider how we could jointly elaborate instruments, means to face the challenges which are ahead of us. How to consolidate the transatlantic community around the notion of the West and its unity. This is the question for Stephen Flanagan. Stephen, the floor is yours.
Great, thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Debski, and thank you for that overly gracious introduction. I can only disappoint after that introduction, I think, but I'll do my best to try to meet the high standards you've set. I think I fully agree with the question that Dr. Debski has posed, the notion that is there really still, and I think particularly now with the Obama administration, as you've heard from Assistant Secretary Gordon and others today, I don't think there's any longer an assessment gap. There are many other gaps, but I think what we have more broadly in the transatlantic relationship is a strategy gap and certain gaps in capabilities. And perhaps, and what I think is causing some concern clearly in Central and Eastern Europe, a United States that is so globally engaged in so many different areas that it seems distracted or disinterested in Central and Eastern Europe, which I hope that Assistant Secretary Gordon, Vice President Biden, and others have disabused you of this earlier, both Secretary Gordon earlier this day and President Biden during his recent visit, Vice President Biden during his recent visit. But let me talk about the why I think there isn't really why I accept the basic premise and argue how we might make some progress in bridging the strategy gap, if you will, if that's really in some ways what the major concern is from my perspective in transatlantic relations today, and what also can be done to help develop consensus and more of a common approach of the West on some of these issues. That we confront now, and I think just to back up my contention that I don't think there's really a strategic assessment gap or huge differences. If you look at a number of recent assessments that have been provided, beginning with the European Security Strategy, the so-called Solana paper, its further refinements, the French white paper, the UK defense strategy, a number of other European defense white papers. And even the last quadrennial defense review of the Bush administration and the 2008 National Defense Strategy, they're all very convergent in the assessment that they offer as to what are the key challenges, particularly in the security area, which is really my focus today, developed democracies really confront and need to confront more effectively together. International terrorism, proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, regional conflict, failed states, and then plus adding to that, of course, the security consequences of climate change, aspects of energy security, and what role the defense and security establishments can play in enhancing energy security. So I don't think there's if you look at these broad range of these assessments, I don't think there are huge differences any longer. Now, there was, of course, an important difference that became a source of tension in the transatlantic relationship and in U.S. relationship with many of its allies, not only in Europe but elsewhere around the world, which was the Bush administration's, in my view, excessive focus on combating terrorism as the keystone, as the lodestone of its overall foreign policy. And earlier this year, we heard John Brennan, the president's advisor, President Obama's advisor for combating terrorism, in this very room, articulate a strategy that made it clear that this is no longer the case in terms of at least the Obama administration's foreign policy, that the combating terrorism is not the lodestone. It is an important and remains an overarching concern of U.S. national security planning, but it is no longer the setting upon which so much else of the Bush policy was oriented, and I think we're already seeing some of the benefits of that. That's not to say that I don't think we still have some important differences, and we see them every day in Afghanistan, over the question of the strategy of dealing with that particular facet of combating terrorism and extremism in the particular operations that allies are committed to in Afghanistan. But I do think that we've at least in the process of recalibrating the focus of U.S. foreign policy, that this has removed or at least begun to remove what was almost a constant irritant, or a sense that it was leading to a complete lack of neglect of the rest of the relationship that we had with many of our key allies, and one that needed to be adjusted. And I think, in fairness, I think this administration has made some real progress in that area. But that said, there do still remain, as I said, I think some important differences over what is the right balance of hard and soft power in dealing not only with terrorism but with a number of other security challenges. And while this administration and, of course, Secretary Clinton is very much seized with the notion of so-called smart power, a concept that we probably had a role of launching in this institution here at CSIS. But what everyone's finding, of course, is that to articulate a concept of smart power and to actually implement one is a vast world of difference and a great deal of friction in actually integrating and implementing this notion of how do we bring together all of the elements of national power and also non-governmental organizations in achieving an effective strategy in a number of complex operations, ranging from Afghanistan to dealing with terrorism to dealing with weak states and many other problems that we don't need to go into here. So I think that what we're finding is while the U.S. is committed to, and of course the initial approach and strategy, the change in strategy in Afghanistan was greeted with great enthusiasm in March and then in the further refinements over the course of this year in Europe, we still see that there are some concerns and hesitation about the proper mix between the hard power counterinsurgency elements of the strategy in Afghanistan and the balance of some of the civil development and civil strengthening of governance capacities are needed in advancing the overall strategy. But that said, I think as we then look at these other challenges that we confront, there is a strong conviction that I think is underpinning the elements of U.S. foreign policy today that when you look at our key allies in NATO, our other European partners, some of our key allies in East Asia and partners in East Asia, that they form a capable core group of countries that can work to promote global growth to deal with some of these other transnational challenges that I discussed, and to also to help manage the consequences of global instability. And so what we are very much still about, and I think what the Obama administration is deeply committed to, is how do we find the right modalities, the right elements of strategy that help us best orchestrate these efforts in an effective way, and that in a division of labor in the conduct of these missions and common interests that these countries that are very much a capable core group of countries that are benefiting from globalization and open trading system and want to be committed to this effort to maintain that system, how do we best orchestrate and integrate those efforts? And so I do think, and to go back to the chair's question, I think what we do need is to continue to deepen and strengthen some of the dialogue on the actual implementation of strategies to deal with some of these problems. And beginning first in NATO, I would argue that NATO has the level of strategic consultation in NATO has really atrophied in recent years. There's been, when you talk to a number of permanent representatives and other participants in regular NATO ministerial meetings, they lament that the discussions have become rather tactical. Even the Bush administration tried on a number of occasions to try to bring to the NATO table which issues that are of concern to the United States and that should be of concern to the wider transatlantic community. Obviously, the developments in Iran, aspects of global terrorism, other issues that affect overall transatlantic security, and finding it very difficult and sometimes even resistance to bringing some of these into the NATO forum. But I do think that it is important that we enrich and revitalize the consultations in NATO on the strategic issues that do affect overall transatlantic security as a way to begin to shape and develop more of a consensus about strategy and a fuller understanding of how differing various countries are pursuing differing approaches in dealing with some of these challenges. So too, and of course, we have even this week another USCU summit where there are some initiatives being launched to help strengthen the USCU dialogue, and particularly with regard to energy questions. And here, I think, once again, the US-EU dialogue, where the United States, I think, very much sees Central and Eastern Europe as a strong participant in the overall shaping of a common European foreign and security policy, a common and foreign security policy which we hope will be more globally engaged as a partner in addressing some of these challenges, and particularly those on the more on the governance and global growth side of the equation, where the EU can bring its important capabilities and acquis into the fray. And so I think that what the United States would like to see is a continued strengthening of the EU's engagement in promoting global growth, in enhancing governance, beginning in many ways in Afghanistan as one of the initial challenges where some of these tools could be brought to bear, but also more broadly. And obviously recognizing that there are important burdens that EU member countries are sharing individually and collectively in promoting global growth and dealing with some of the root causes of instability around the world, and that we need to take that into account as we look at the overall balance and assessment of burden sharing in promoting these mutual interests. But I do think that the US-EU dialogue, again, there have been a number of different suggestions about specific modalities that could be undertaken to how to enrich that dialogue at a time when European ministers and of all, not just foreign ministers, but of all sorts of portfolios are talking to each other on a regular basis. How do we ensure that in deepening transatlantic cooperation on a number of key issues continues to develop in the area of the EU's acquis, how do we ensure that there's a deepening of US-EU cooperation as well in some of these key areas? And this ranges from everything from questions of climate change, of China's rise, of the rise of the other major powers. How's that impacting transatlantic interests and transatlantic where are there opportunities for cooperation with other regions and entities in the global system? So I think that in terms of pathways to narrow some of the strategy gap, I do think that these are two areas that both in we have to enrich some of the strategic dialogue so that we can come to some more common assessments on strategy and common approaches as a way to begin to narrow this lingering strategy gap. And given the number of parents on the panel, I should probably stop there and look forward to further discussion. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Stephen. Stephen gave me a kind of early warning that he's going to run at 2:30. So after this first wave of questions, I'm going to open the floor for the questions directed to Steve. Now I would like to turn to Professor Adam Daniel Rotfeld with the following another question. Well, unilateral moment has gone forever. We have been witnessing the process of shaping a new order, definitely multipolar, or at least bipolar. It means that one day the tendency may appear to come out with the notion of division of labor between these new polars. So I would like to ask Adam Daniel Rotfeld how we should shape this multipolar world in order to secure world democratic values as a governing principle of international relations?
Thank you very much. In fact, it is not my intention, I would say, to discuss this element of polarity because very often people are speaking about unipolarity, multipolarity, bipolarity. In fact, polarity, it is, I would say, something very exceptional in international relations. It happened after the Second World War, and it was taken from the science, from physics, where, in fact, polarity is based on very simple understanding that there are only two poles, plus and minus. There is no unipolarity or multipolarity. Russians, by the way, they decided recently to take rid of that description of multipolarity, which has had behind, I would say, the concept of multipolarity was the concept of privileged zones of interest or zone of influences. Unipolarity, it is hegemony. In other words, Russians recently started to speak about polycentric world, and this is something what could be accepted. But in general, I would like to say that international politics often is about different narratives, different perceptions, of reality and about the persistence of historical experience. It happened that as co-chairman of the Russian-Polish group on difficult matters, I noticed how difficult it is to offer the same perception for effects which are accepted by both sides, but they have totally different understanding. And as far as Russia is concerned, I would like to say that there are three different approaches in Western community. From the American perspective, Russia is seen mainly through the prism of preventing proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, of arms control, and counterterrorism. Some other elements were mentioned by Steve a while ago, like the concept of combating international criminal organizations, the question of the international piracy, etc. In Western Europe, the Western powers, Germany, France, to some extent the United Kingdom, but definitely Spain, Italy, for them, Russia is mainly not only potential, but a real partner in economy. And in other words, political and economic perception is decisive. They developed a kind of the friendly and cooperative concept based on a pre-assumption that Russia is a kind of the decisive factor, an important fundament of peace and security in Europe. And last but not least, Central Eastern Europe, because we are mainly focused at the moment on the perception in our region, is motivated very often by fear and threat for simple reason that neighboring countries of the Central Eastern Europe, for those countries, Russia might infringe on their sovereignty, for whom military security from Russia and questions of justice and human rights are the top priority. I would like to say that, of course, it is very divergent. One should not say that the Central Eastern European nations, they have the same understanding of different developments. In Russia, for example, it is definitely not the same understanding in Poland, in Hungary, in Czech Republic, or Slovakia. It is not my intention now to enter into the divergences, but I would like simply to make a kind of the flash and to say this is, I would say, what are three approaches, a little bit simplified, not to say oversimplified. As far as development in Russia, I would like to say that, in fact, I have to accept each and every word presented today by Zbigniew Brzeziński, because in my view, he has done, I would say, really excellent analysis, and he was in a position to offer us a kind of the understanding of main problems which Russia is now confronted with. I have in mind, I would say, these two Russias, as he said, one motivated by nostalgia and motivated by a new type of revisionism. Some of us remember that for Russia in the whole post-war period, the key word of the Russia's foreign and security policy, it was status quo, political and military status quo. In other words, to keep what happened after the Second World War as a kind of the new reality forever. Partition of Europe, partition of Germany, recognition of the Russian influence in Central Eastern Europe. That was, I would say, the goal and, I would say, the main motive. At the moment, in opposite, Russia is very much motivated by a need to reestablish, to restore the previous position. And frankly, it is impossible. To some extent, I would like to say that Russia's reaction is, analogies are always very risky, but nevertheless, I would like to say that almost all great powers who have their colonies, I would say imperial powers, like especially continental, like Ottoman Empire, Austro-Hungarian Empire, Russian Empire, they have very similar reaction. And it seems to me that at the moment, I would say the main driving force of assertive imperial policy of Russia is status, to be recognized as a kind of the global power comparable to the United States. The, as the result, I would say the main task for the political elite is how to reestablish lost influence on the global stage due to energy alliances with a variety of countries. Russia is not interested to be integrated to the Western communities. Rather, it is the concept, as I said already, of polycentric world. To come to some final comments, I would like to say that Russia lost its global competition with the United States and the Western countries during the Cold War, but political elite continued to perceive the world through the prism of great power politics. And in other words, the goal is to restore and extend Russia's primacy. Main political philosophy as the result is geostrategy. It is, by the way, interesting. Geostrategy as a political concept was invented by Germans before the First World War with an intention to justify why Germany has to be extended. And it was for many, many years, for generations, was forgotten. Now geostrategy is again, I would say, a very popular word, and in my view, it is rather the reflection of the inability to describe, to define in proper way the new realities. Definitely, in my view, geostrategy is not the concept addressed to the future. It is rather deep-rooted in the past. The result of this geostrategic approach of Russia is revisionism. And revisionism, not of the type as it was known after the Second World War, but rather typical to the situation of Weimar Republic after the First World War. And I would like to say that it is not without reasons that Putin, during his visit in Poland, the 1st of September in Gdańsk, he made a kind of the analogy to Germany. By the way, he suggested to Poland that we should follow the pattern of reconciliation between Germany and Russia. And he said that the beginning and the origins of the Second World War were not because they, first of all, that they were deep-rooted in the results of the First World War, but not because of the lost war by Germany, but because of the fact that Germany was humiliated. Great powers, he said, should not be humiliated. And in my discussion with my Russian partners, immediately after that speech, I told them that he's absolutely right. Great powers should never be humiliated, but small and medium-sized countries should not be humiliated as well. In other words, it is a need to accept that all nations should be respected. And this is, I would say, a very important element. It seems to me that today it was all, in one of the speeches, probably it was because I do not remember now exactly who said what, but it was probably Mr. Gordon who said that there are some rules which Russia would like to offer as a kind of the basic rules of conduct, rules of behavior within the new security architecture. And these rules are eliminating the set of norms and principles, how they were negotiated within the Helsinki process, and they are reflected in the documents of the Helsinki Final Act. And it seems to me that when we are now coming back to the discussion about the future security architecture, there is a need to bring back, I would say, not only the rules of conduct, but also some values and principles. In other words, the international politics and also our strategy towards Russia should be based not only on the balance of interests, but also on the balance of interests and values. This is a very fundamental issue. In other words, and this is my last point, is that a great debate how to engage Russia has been launched in Washington, Brussels, Berlin, and many other European capitals. But there is no comparable debate in Moscow, where the Western positive approach is very often interpreted as a weakness of the United States and confirmation of the right strategy taken up by Russia. In Russia, the debate focuses on geopolitics and geopolitical approaches to policy making, on failures the West is responsible for, and on the need of others to take Russia's security interests into consideration. In consensus in Moscow is reflecting a kind of the skepticism that the United States and the Western powers and the Western world as a whole is indeed really ready seriously to review their foreign and security policies to take greater account of Russian interests. There are some signals, however, that sent by recently by Russian leadership that indicate a shift may be underway. In other words, policy not only towards Afghanistan and Iran, but first of all, it seems to me that some recent speeches and recent evaluation made by Dmitry Medvedev, they should be taken in very serious way. And to what extent it is, I would say, the reflection of the reality, and to what extent it is an intention to impress the public, it is for me an open question. In other words, what Brzezinski said today, I do not know whether in these two camps of Putin and Medvedev, to which camp Medvedev belongs. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Professor Rothfeld. Thank you very much for bringing us to the issue of Russia as the subject which could potentially help us to reunite around the notion of the West. Let's test this argument. I would like to give the floor to Kari Lik and I would like to turn her with the following question. How we could see this recent policy of the United States? Can it help us to, as I said, be more united? Can this policy enhance the transatlantic community?
Thank you, Slavomir. It's a great pleasure to me to be speaking here. As regards the reset policy, actually there seem to be different concepts as to what that is. There are people who say that the reset policy is an ongoing policy and a long process. Then there are other people who say that reset policy is about getting rid of the legacy of Bush, all bad feelings from old times, so that we can get down to work. And then there are others who say that reset has been done. We are on new ground now, and this is it. So it's unclear as to whether this was something that was one-off or is it process. disturbed by those people who say that reset has been done, because that, for me, demonstrates that there are many people who are looking for quick fixes in relationship with Russia, but my deep conviction is that it is possible to make Russia more cooperative toward the West, but it cannot happen overnight. It requires patience and time from our side. And so to expect that with one speech or one policy initiative, we have made Russia's paradigm of behavior any different, this, I think, is wrong. So as defined by many official U.S. representatives, the reset policy means that we will work with Russia where we can, but we won't accept the spheres of influence. And that actually, I think, is fine, with me at least. It's a good approach. But the question here is, to what extent or how much time and energy the U.S., in cooperation with Europe, of course, is prepared to spend on preventing the spheres of influence from taking shape. Because it's one thing not to accept them in words, but it's other thing to actually counter them by active measures. Now, when I say active measures, many people, especially in Europe, would watch me with scared eyes, thinking that I'm talking about countering Russia somehow militarily or something similar. That I don't think is necessary, at least for as long as we are willing to counter Russia by other means. Military means will never be necessary. So how to prevent Russia from acquiring spheres of influence? Well, let's first define what is sphere of influence, or what Russia sees as one. It's the territory of the former Soviet Union, of course. Georgia and Ukraine are currently the hotspot, because preventing Georgia and Ukraine from getting into NATO is something that matters to Moscow a great deal. But I think Russia has a soft spot for much of the former Warsaw Pact. So that is by and large what they have seen as their sphere of influence and probably would love to see once again. How do we go about it? I think as we are very different countries belonging to different organizations in different levels of development, different problems, there is not one set of measures, not a single recipe. But it depends. I think with countries such as Georgia and Ukraine, for example, for now, it would be a very good start if we established Western presence there, so that we would be knowing that Russia is up to, and that we would be ready to say out what we know. The war in Georgia, in a way, is a kind of textbook example of how to do things wrong. I think the West could have prevented that war from happening had we been present, had, say, the European Union taken over the OSCE's observer mission in 2005, the continuation of which Russia blocked, but that was a very effective mission. Had an observer mission similar to the current EU mission been present before the war? Had it been watching what was happening between Russia and Georgia? And had it spelled out its conclusions? I think things would have been different, because Russia would have known that the West knows what it's up to. But we didn't do that. We didn't have people there. And even when we examined certain incidents, such as a missile that was dropped on Georgia's soil a year before the war, we were too scared to spell out the conclusion that the missile actually came from Russia. I mean, the result of that commission was the report was very, very muddled, and there were deep conflicts as to how much to spell out publicly. And that left us with an option of non-recognition policy towards South Ossetia and Abkhazia, but that is post factum. We could have been much more active and prevented this thing from happening. In certain countries, that also includes Georgia and Ukraine, but many others, a good way is to use the instrument of, say, European neighbourhood policy or Eastern Partnership, as the necessary thing to do is to strengthen domestic institutions. In some of these countries, such as much of Eastern and Central European countries that are members of the of NATO and the European Union, basically all we need to do is to make sure that these countries are seen and treated as equal members of the alliances, and no exceptions that favor Russia would be allowed. And here I mean, say, defense planning in respect of the new members of NATO, or say the universality of European, say, even trade agreements with Russia. I mean, Russia wanted to exclude Poland wanted to exclude Polish meat from its market, which was impossible to do because Poland didn't exist in trade terms anymore. It was the European Union. Still, Russia tried to make Poland exempt from the agreement it had with the EU. So there is really a different set of things to do, or different sets. But these are not military, and these are not very complicated. However, it'll take time. I think what is needed is a coherent and sustainable policy towards Russia that is based on Western values. And coherent and sustainable it has to be for a long time, because so far we have not been very coherent and very sustainable. And that makes Russia not take us seriously enough as a partner. And that makes it hard for Russia itself to set its goals. You know, when asked what does Russia want, I don't think Russia knows what it wants in international life. One can define a few things that Russia certainly wants. Yes, to prevent Georgia and Ukraine from getting into NATO. And yes, a monopoly on gas trade. But on other things, it depends what Russia can get, and they don't know what they can get. And they have these periods of high expectations sometimes when they behave very arrogantly. I mean, we have seen Russian Prime Minister telling the European Commission that you need us more than we need you. Or we have seen Russian Foreign Minister addressing his British counterpart with the F word. And then there are other times when Russia is backtracking on all accounts, and is actually worried about the survival of its own regime, is panicking about another Orange Revolution happening in Russia. So it really fluctuates. And I think these fluctuations depend on many issues, such as oil price, such as domestic circumstances in Russia, the proximity of elections or not. Also, the West, to what extent the West is united, how it is doing in Iraq and Afghanistan. When they see American power bogged down in Mesopotamia, they think that they can do more. When they see that America is doing well in Iraq and Afghanistan, Russia becomes much more restrained. But in this environment, when the world for Russia is in flux, it is not in their incentive to adopt a cooperative approach or any firm approach of any kind, actually. I think that Russia's position on Iran is a very telling example. They try to keep that position of potential spoiler or potential deal maker, but they avoid becoming one or another because they benefit from giving these promises and keeping possibility to blackmail, because then the West will, on many other questions, think that we must take into account Russia's position because we need Russia on Iran. Russia's behavior is not really focused on issues that have to be solved. Russia's behavior is focused on increasing Russia's room for maneuver. And if we want Russia to adopt any firm positions at all, I think our own more principled and more clear approach towards Russia is needed. Also, internally, Russia lacks checks and balances. And many Russian Democrats tell me that they regret that the West, by imposing a kind of set of external checks and balances, doesn't try to help it, because external environment will have a big influence on how Russia develops internally as well. And I think a kind of predictable external environment where Western values are guiding principle makes bad scenarios in Russia more unlikely. If the world is chaos, then bad things happening in Russia are much more likely. So I think that if reset is really seen as a policy that requires time and energy and effort, then it can be successful, and it certainly is a policy where the United States and Europe can cooperate, because we have different toolboxes, and there are areas which are easier to handle for European Union with its possibilities. There are things that NATO does better, and there are things that United States does the best. But I think by pooling our resources, we can achieve a lot. And one final remark about the letter. I think from my perspective, the reason for Central and East European countries to be writing such a letter together is also value-related. I mean, we benefited greatly from the world of the 1990s, which was guided by Western values, and where countries could join the organizations if they wanted and if they qualified. And that was, for us, I mean, small and not so small, Central and Eastern European countries, that was the thing that put our fate into our own hands, which has not always been the case in our history. And I think we don't see immediate threat from Russia towards us, but the possibility that this principle is going into history and new spheres of influence will emerge, I think that is something that is threatening in itself for us, even though we might happen to be on the right side of the Iron Curtain this time. But the existence of new Iron Curtain or new spheres of influence is bad in itself. And that's why I think we talk about Western values so much today, and I think here, I mean, in this company of Americans and East and Central Europeans, we understand what we are talking about. But actually, in many other countries, when you say values, people think you are being cynical and trying to justify either imperial policies, spheres of influence, or whatsoever. And I'm not talking only about Russia, where cynicism is prevailing mood for many years already, but also in Western Europe. So values the concept of values as such has been discredited largely by Bush years, because Bush often used values to justify policies that sometimes were dubious or at least gave results that were not the best. And hence, I think I really wish the new U.S. administration will manage to restore the concept of values as such, as a kind of guiding principle, as a set of rules and taboos that is in the air, because that affects the behavior of countries as well as people, including people at ballot box, and that will determine or at least influence what kind of people race to the top, also in Central and Eastern European countries. And that's to address the worries that the letter raised about the domestic developments in these countries. I think the kind of overall atmosphere helps a lot in that respect.
Thank you very much, Kadri. The long shadow of Russia has reached us in Washington, D.C. Stephen, can you still be with us for 10 minutes? Okay, so I would like to give the floor to Andrzej Olechowski. I would like to ask him the following question. There is a new animal on the horizon. I mean G20, new institution, which shadow may also influence transatlantic relations somehow. For many, many years, the rules of the game in world economy has been set by Europe and United States. Nowadays, it seems that more and more often, these rules of the game may be shaped in other regions of the world, and I'm not quite sure whether it could happen in favor of values and traditions of transatlantic community. How we can deal with that?
Okay, Chairman, I'll be very brief. It's not only because I would like to benefit from Mr. Flanagan's answering questions, and I would like to get back to Russia discussion, but also because I think that the issue of economic governance and G20 and related problems will not be high on the agenda, on the U.S. Central Europe agenda. G20 is an effort to adjust the form of international dialogue to the changing realities of the global situation. Now we do that because we are unwilling or unable, depending on the country, to reform United Nations. Otherwise, we should have been doing that in UN. But we're seeking for some other forms of for some other arrangements. G20 will be a forum to address global issues, not only economic issues, also security and others, in the form that has been done in the past in G7 and G8. However, G20 will be too diverse in its membership, both in terms of levels of development, economic development, as to the levels of institutional development. Take on one hand EU members, United States, on the other hand Argentina and Russia, not prepared to do certain things. Its guidelines, because I don't think we can call it differently, its guidelines will be done at the pretty low common denominator, and therefore relatively easy to be accommodated by different countries around. It will not be, though, a forum for setting the rules for economic governance. I don't believe so. I think for a foreseeable future, such a dialogue and such a forum will be U.S. EU dialogue. Atlantic era remains the center of the global economic, center of gravity of the global economic activity. China, India, and other places, and other emerging markets are very important and growing fast, but still the flows, including those countries, are not to be compared with the enormous weight of Euro-Atlantic era, which is what, about 40% of international trade today. So this dialogue will remain critical for the years to come. And for example, if US and EU agree on accounting rules, this will be this will have a huge effect on the world economy at large. Now, where are the Central European countries in this thing? The only thing I can say intelligently about that is that perhaps I see more divergence than convergence of interest here. Central European countries will continue to be interested in as open a world economic system as possible. And United States, given its current state of mind, may not be so favorable to that concept. It is, by the way, quite amazing that the country and nation that benefited most from globalization is now so so concerned about that. I'm talking about public opinion, but also leadership. That so many, for example, trade agreements are waiting to be approved and are being considered so controversial. It's very paradoxical that countries that used to, in the past, call globalization the another form of American imperialism are now the staunch defenders of globalization and promoters, and are defending it against America, which is trying to limit it. But this is what really is happening. But anyway, conclusion. There's not going to be an important item on Central Europe-US agenda. It will continue to be an important and perhaps growing in importance item on the US-EU agenda.
Thank you very much, Minister. And right now I'd like to open the floor for questions addressed to Steve Flanagan. Please introduce yourself.
Regina Frakolbiak. During the morning session, Mr. Poyer briefly mentioned that he would like to see U.S. getting more involved in Belarus. What would be your opinion as an American representative? Another question from your point of view, and given that you had the opportunity to give an advice to the Polish government, in which ways, or in other words, how should Polish government develop, in which way develop a good relationship with Russia, if any? That's all.
Thank you. Well, on Belarus, I mean, it seems to me that this is a classic illustration of where the United States working with the EU and the neighborhood policy could be helpful in strengthening civil society and democratization and the stirrings that we see in Belarus and working also even outside that with I've heard that also the Ukrainians have talked about their growing dialogue and cooperation with reform movements in Belarus. So the notion, the potential for various arrays of governmental and non-governmental cooperation to help strengthen civil society and the development of democratic trends in Belarus are great opportunities. So, I mean, I think this is – and it's also the kind of thing that, I mean, I should be a part of the regular dialogue, I think, of the transatlantic dialogue, both in the US-EU context and, you know, when there are these stirrings when in terms of the notion of the potential for real shifts in governance and political developments in some of these countries, how are we working to orchestrate and integrate our policies and engagement? I mean, during the time of reform of Mr. Olhoski and others would know well, you know, when support to the U.S. Was investing a lot more money in supporting democratization through the SEED program and others, there was a great deal of integration and coordination between U.S. and EU technical assistance efforts and things of this nature. And I think some of this could be, you know, could be revitalized, although I don't expect there'll be, you know, vast new resources available for this, but there are a lot of things that are going on, and there are instruments that are outside a governmental sphere that can have real effect. On Russia, I knew that Kadri was asked to address the Russia question, and so I didn't really touch on it, but that obviously is one of the other key elements where there is a gap on strategy. What is the right mix of resolve and engagement with Russia, be it from the NATO-Russia aspect and also in the context of the U.S. Resetting of the relationship with Russia? I mean, I think right now my assessment is the Obama administration is still waiting for the reset on the Russian side. There has not really been as much of a shift as was hoped for in some of the aspects of Russian thinking and the cooperative the tone has shifted in some positive directions, and obviously there's progress being made on the extension of the START Treaty and the Moscow Treaty. That there has not been as much of a sense of a real shift in attitude. That there's still some of the overhang in some of the rhetoric and uncertainty about where Russia will go with regard to this, you know, abandoning spheres of influence thinking and some of the other things that are clearly limitations. And what principles will they accept? What do they really, as Kadri put it, what do they really want? In any kind of adjustments of the new of a new Eurasian Euro-Atlantic security system, so I think that the Polish government, and I heard Minister Sikorski earlier this week and other senior Polish officials talk about. I think Poland has a very clear strategy. It recognizes that it has enormous stakes in developing a good relationship, just because of economic exposure and other considerations, but also because of geography and how do we engage? How do we engage Russia? But with a sense that there have to be some rules of the road, and that there are some behaviors and some policies that are unacceptable, and where the Russia, where the West as a whole is willing to push back. And I think we may have an opportunity to again, test this out and the elements of cooperation that we achieved at different points. If there is another crisis over gas with Ukraine this winter, I mean, I think there'll be another opportunity here to. Some of the problem may be of Ukraine's own making. On the other hand, certain aspects of Russian behavior, if it's undertaken in a way that is undermining broader interests that Ukrainian the West has in Ukraine and Ukrainian sovereignty, I think the opportunity here for collective action will present itself again, and hopefully it'll be a way to demonstrate that there can be something that we can still move forward with engagement with Russia, but also push back when Russia is engaged in unacceptable behavior of trying to compromise the sovereignty of its neighbors.
Thank you very much. Extremists from the right and from the left are kindly welcomed also to take the floor. There is a question, sir.
This one. Thank you. I'm not used to all this technology. I'm Julian Josephson with Bootstrap Press here in Maryland, a nonprofit organization. What came to mind was that the United States and Central Eastern Europe have parallel interests in abating greenhouse gases and, like carbon dioxide and so on, and perhaps divergent approaches to it. But now it seems so fin prévu that the United States could be going to Copenhagen rather empty-handed. Do you believe, and I guess I probably want to address this to the Polish ministers here, do you believe that if America fails to come up with something really concrete at Copenhagen, that this too will detract from the ability of the European powers to speed up the abatement of greenhouse gases? And do you think also Russia would cooperate with the Central Eastern European countries in helping to abate greenhouse gases?
Okay, is there any question to Steve Flanagan? Here, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bartosz Wiśniewski from the Polish Institute of International Affairs. Sir, and I've referred to Mr. Flanagan, if I were to oversimplify your argument, your initial argument, and please forgive me if I oversimplify it too starkly, the way to bridge the strategic gap that you have mentioned would be to talk to each other more seriously, and that's a very good way to do it. But what is the crucial question is with whom should the United States talk, actually? We talked a lot about Lisbon Treaty and what is it going to change in the coming years, but as we all know, the European Union is a mechanism that moves forward really, really slowly, perhaps even more slowly than the U.S. administration. And I'm very much under influence by the recent report of the European Council on Foreign Relations, which said that for Europe, for the European Union to be a meaningful partner to the United States, it would have to start talking with one voice on such issues as Russia, Afghanistan, and so on and so forth. Now, let alone whether this is possible at all, but the real question is, what is the degree of patience on the U.S. side to actually wait for Europe to make up its mind on these issues? And someone who has been close to various administrations, would, I believe, be the right person to answer the question. What is the degree of patience on the U.S. side? Thank you.
Thank you. No, it's an excellent question, and you didn't oversimplify. I didn't want to take too much time to elaborate on. I mean, I agree that dialogue in and of itself, more structured and effective strategic dialogue, isn't going to overcome all these problems, but I do think it can be part of the solution to beginning to develop and bridge some of the differences that we have on strategy, and to develop more coordinated approaches to dealing with some of these issues that have oftentimes. I think drifted because of misperceptions and lack of understanding on some of these questions, but also to maintain, as the chairman put it to us, the sense of the West and the commonality of approach in dealing with these interests. I think that the United States has to be patient. It doesn't really have much alternative. I mean, it's the fact of the matter that I do think that, as a number of speakers have alluded to, I mean this. The European Union countries, a number of other key partners around the world, are some of the most capable countries in dealing with some of these global challenges that not only this administration but the previous administration finally came to be quite clear about it, that it these can't be, even at the height of U.S. power, many of these challenges could not be addressed through unilateral measures. We needed to develop effective cooperative policies and partnerships with a wider range of actors and institutions, to include the non-governmental sector. So how do we orchestrate all of that? Yes, indeed, there's clearly a great deal of frustration in Washington still about Europe's contribution. The most immediate challenge, if you will, in terms of the Obama's administration's effort to adapt the strategy with regard to Afghanistan, and a frustration in the sense that. In all the areas that the United States has looked most strongly to Europe for, on rule of law, on enhancing governance, on police training, other things that European capabilities have not been forthcoming, and there certainly is a sense of frustration. On the other hand, there's the question of looking at the alternative. If you didn't have the contributions that number of governments have made to some of those aspects of the mission, think of the overstretch the fact that the U.S. capabilities are already overtaxed, particularly in the military sphere. If you didn't have these contributions to the NATO training mission, if you didn't have this additional involvement in some other aspects of enhancing civil capacity in Afghanistan, the enormity of that burden would still fall, would fall more fully to the United States. So I don't know. When does the patience run out? I do think that you could see some catalytic efforts too that bring the two sides of the Atlantic together more forcefully. I mean, obviously, there's still important differences over how immediate or how real the threat from Iran is. But what if it did become more apparent that there was this very near term. Threat to, and that Iran did intend to use perhaps either the acquisition of acquisition and testing or at least the acquisition of all of the capabilities needed to have a nuclear weapon. how would it use that, and could it use it in ways that would be very damaging to broader Western interests, not only in the Middle East but elsewhere? And would that begin to galvanize a more unified approach? So, I mean, I don't rule out the idea that there could be some of these other catalytic events that could bring the West together, somewhat in a, obviously on a more of in a negative way, but I guess I don't really have a good answer for your question, but I don't think the U.S. has any alternative but to be patient and try to continue to shape and encourage this broader engagement. I mean, this is a process in many ways that has been going on really over the last 25 years, and I think the U.S. has welcomed the idea of a stronger and more capable European. I mean, there's been sometimes uncertainty about what it might mean and the loss of U.S. Influence or ability to be as directive in the development of Western policy, but the notion of a strong and capable set of European partners engaged with us more globally, and not only in the security area, but in all these other areas of economic development, civil action, and so if we can continue to try to find ways to do that more effectively, I think that the American body politic will recognize that there may be differences in the way the labor is shared, but that there is still much to be benefited to U.S. interests by continued cooperation.
Can I add something to that?
Absolutely.
That one has to also admit that this frustration, as you said, and the U.S. expectation as to the coherence and coordination of European policies is relatively recent. U.S. was quite pleased with having Europe, shall we say, scrambled for a long time, and in fact was carefully making sure that Europe is not too coherent and not too coordinated. One example and one reason of that one result of this policies that we should correct relatively quickly is the lack of representation of European Union in the NATO and the lack of cooperation between the two institutions. And it's not because of EU reluctance, but very much because of the NATO reluctance.
We will correct it.
We need to correct it because in more and more eras, it is European Union which is relevant for NATO and not individual countries anymore. Mm-hmm. In a modern, particularly in anti-terrorist, when there is a concern about anti-terrorism, anti-terrorist, it's EU, very often more relevant than NATO. Let me answer your questions there in the following way. I simply can't believe that U.S. would come to Copenhagen empty-handed. If there is a policy, an issue, which symbolizes the new approach to international relations that Barack Obama promises and preaches, it is the climate. It is the environmental policy. That is that we are all partners, that we all have to take responsibility, and that we all have to share in the solution. So if U.S. were to come empty-handed to that conference, that I truly believe would create a collapse in U.S. Credibility around the world. Now, your second part of the question is, if U.S. came empty-handed, could we replace it with, could Russia sort of replace this contribution? No, of course not. And of course the whole thing would be seriously damaged.
Okay. Steve is, unfortunately, has to leave.
My sincere apologies. Yeah. This panel timing shifted, and I have something, as you can see, that something we've already scheduled here that I have to attend.
Thank you very much.
Apologies,
thank you very much.
It was a pleasure joining you. My apologies to all of
you. We open. I open the floor for the questions addressed to our three speakers. So probably we'll come back to the issue of Russia. But I would like to continue for a moment the issue of G20 and the climate change. simple reason. In G20, Europe has been represented by six countries. Germany, France, Great Britain, Italy, Spain, and Holland. And during last Pittsburgh summit, the position of Europe has been shaped by these six countries. And in the end of the day, the situation produced tensions within the European Union. And last summit in Brussels, that was a case of lack of consultations. How the Central Europe may fit to this global agenda? We have very divergent interests in terms of our state of affairs in our economy. We are quite often being presented as dirt partners. How we could reintroduce ourselves to this debate?
Yes, you need to know that in Poland, and I suppose in some other countries around the world, which have sizable economies, and we believe we are 18th economy in the world now by the nominal total GDP. There is a concern that they should be represented. If this is the group of 20 leading economies in the world, then of course 18th economy should be represented. But this is not my concern. I believe there are two statements here. One is if you don't feel represented, and if you have some other concerns than those which are raised by these 20 countries, there is something wrong with you, okay? Because they, as I said, they represent such an array of actual level of developments and such an array of institutional solutions that they adopt that it's really hard not to be represented by those 20 countries, including by the six Europeans. And secondly, If the six Europeans were to offer formal commitments for the whole of EU, which they didn't, of course, I would not feel at all obliged by them because they do not represent the European Union. They represent European economy as a general concept. They don't represent me. So I would only back up their solutions and they form my commitments if I felt that they in line with my own policy.
Okay. I saw the question. Yeah?
Thank you. My name is Ben Zagonda. I'm from the Hungarian-American Coalition. My name is Ben Zagonda. I'm from the Hungarian-American Coalition. And I have a question regarding cooperation within the region. I find it a little bit disappointing that we had little discussion about cooperations within the region today, although I think like after 20 years of the regime change, with the help of the Western countries to develop our own free and democratic society, our own political system, develop our economy, we should take the initiative to cooperate with each other. One example, the Visegrad cooperation is a great example of that, and I'm a bit disappointed that we had little discussion about that today, although I think that would be really important to do. And I would like to ask the speakers, what do they think, do they see an opportunity for that to have a stronger cooperation within our countries in the future, and how would that affect U.S. and Central European relations?
We'll collect some questions.
Stephen Blank, U.S. Army War College. We've heard a lot of discussions today about Russia, but I'd like to ask the panelists if they could be a little bit more specific. What exactly is the nature of the problem or the threat that Russia poses? Is it the military one that Foreign Minister Sikorsky addressed, or is it the use of the energy weapon, to blackmail or then the funding from that to subvert European governments? Or is it a combination of the three, or is it something else entirely?
Okay. Kadri?
Yes. Well, my understanding is that Russia would like to control its neighbors and tries to use different means. In Georgia, we could see that that Russia resorted to war in order to prevent Georgia from getting into NATO or in order to revenge to America, because many Russians these days say that, that actually the war in Georgia was all about Russian-American relationship, and Georgia was just used as a pawn in that conflict. Then energy weapon, yes, Russia has used trace weapons. I mean, against Estonia, for example, when we had problem with Russia in 2007, they imposed the so-called Cray sanctions, which meant that Russian businessmen were discouraged from doing business in Estonia or with Estonia. No official sanctions were announced, but simply they were told. So there are all kinds of different things. And also, I mean, the thing that explains Russian behavior is Russia's domestic logic. About a year ago, I interviewed many Russian sociologists, the independent ones, and quite unanimously they said that this political system needs an enemy figure in order to survive and legitimize itself. Because the society is apathetic and badly structured, democratic institutions do not work, I mean, various reasons. And hence these propaganda attacks against neighbors, against Georgia, Ukraine, etc. And for a long time, these are virtual attacks. And some people argue that actually the war in Georgia happened accidentally because this virtual attack turned into military. Psychologically, this can look true, but actually militarily it isn't, because such an operation takes a while to prepare. But still, I mean, these propaganda attacks, they shape public opinion in Russia. And I don't buy that argument at all, that some of his rhetoric is for domestic consumption. I mean, by giving it to domestic consumption, you shape the domestic demand. And that can bode very bad consequences for the future. So my big fear about Russia also is Russia turning into nationalist and xenophobic. It's not unavoidable, but risk development is there. Luckily, not yet beyond the point of no return, but we don't know. It depends on so many issues how we will continue.
Professor Rothfeld?
Well, I would like to support what Kadri said, namely, it seems to me that the threat is, since you mentioned, I would say, military and energetic security, I would say that, in my view, the main problem is not from Russia, but within Russia. As long as there is no internal system which will promote some fundamental basic values, we are confronted with a situation that somebody in search for to neutralize the possible revolutionary situation within the country is a kind of the escape forward by presenting some nations as the possible enemies. And in fact, paradoxically, in recent 300 years, Russia never has had so friendly security environment in the West as it is at the moment. In other words, from Russia's point of view, it is the most comfortable situation. Nevertheless, Russia is not speaking about the real threats. Real threats are in the south and in the east. But it is very often this rhetoric of the Cold War very much in use, I would say. Nobody within the political elites believes in that. They know it, that it is not true. But nevertheless, it is offered as a kind of the religion. And time is ripe, I would say, in case that somebody would raise the question. The question was not raised, but I noticed that we are not in a position to exhaust the subject, but people are exhausted and they are leaving the room. And at the end of the day, only between us, we will discuss. But therefore, I'm using this opportunity to say that if it is a question is raised, what kind of expectations are addressed to Russia in the context of the agenda? I would say that they are very modest. In fact, for example, to stop the Cold War propaganda and this distorted presentation of NATO. This is one point. And another point is that in recent years, all liberal Democrats, there were not too many, but even that very limited number is totally marginalized. And I would like to say that fortunately, it was established Carnegie Endowment Center in Moscow, and within this Carnegie, it is a group of people, best and brightest people in Russia, just to offer them the possibility to address to the public opinion through the television. It should not be the main channel, but one of the channels, very marginal. In other words, what is needed is a kind of the orientation to the normalcy. This is, in my view, the main. And I would like to use an opportunity to say about the cooperation between the Central Eastern European countries. I would like to say that to some extent it is done, to much greater extent than I expected. The problems between the neighboring countries in the region are very deep-rooted in history. And it is much easier to say it for the researchers, for academicians, scientists, what has to be done. Because we can construct always some models. And models, by the definition, they are very attractive. They should be proportional, logical, consistent, and elegant in presentation. I would like to say that the political life is not elegant at all. And we have a lot of problems between, for example, Romania, Hungary, Romania and Ukraine, Hungary and Slovakia. And we should not ignore, it is not a subject, we do not discuss, it is not the subject of our meeting today. But one should take this, for example, between Poland and Lithuania, we have done a lot in order to improve our relations, and fortunately there are no serious problems. But there are some nitty-gritty questions, for example, the form of the description of the Polish names in the ID documents. And I suppose that it was Minister Olechowski 20 years ago who initiated the discussion, and the present minister is still discussing. The problem is very marginal. But on the other hand, for historical sensitivity, we should not ignore even such marginal issues. And this is, I would say, the question why it is so difficult to establish. And last but not least, the main element is that those countries are not compatible, they are competitive. They need the same, and they are offering the same. And this is the main reason why it is so difficult to establish a kind of the integration which is sort of deep-rooted in the political and economic and social life of the countries under consideration.
Minister Olechowski on Russia.
Before we drop that, right? I follow with a great interest the discussion on Russia because I believe this is the most important challenge and task that we have, we, the West, on our agenda for the years to come. And this is, in fact, an item that you, Mr. Dembski, I believe, said may help to consolidate West, define the West in the years to come. However, when I listen to it, I don't find the most important challenge that we face, and that is how to influence Russia in its decision-making process as to which of the two options that that Zbigniew Brzeziński described they should check, nostalgic or modernization or integration model. We sort of wait for the outcome of the internal debate. Obviously, this would be only Russians and only Russians which will take the final decision. But can we influence them in that? Can we push them? Can we help them to take the decision that we would like them very much to take, which is the modernization decision and not the nostalgic decision? I don't want them to put that bear on the plane again, because when they crash, they will create some damage among us as well. Okay? And drawing on my own experience, and when I remember the beginning of our transformation, you know, now from the historical perspective, it may look as Poles were unified in their desire to join NATO and European Union. Yes, eventually we were, but this was not sort of an instinctive choice. When I concluded negotiations of the association treaty with European Union, there were a sizable number of politicians who were suggesting we start immediately negotiating association treaty with CIS, because Poland should be a country open to both groupings in Europe. And we were explaining that Poland is not China and it's not country of the middle. All right, but it is a country of the West. But this was now what made our policy choice eventually so solid and so much shared by the population, by the whole country, whole nation, was the fact that we were told by the West that we would be welcomed. We were told, yes, you get ready, you do this, you do that, but we would like you to join us. We would like you to be our members. Both NATO and European Union were telling us that. Did we tell Russians that we would welcome them in anything? Did we ever propose to Russians that we want them to be members of this or that, particularly we, Europeans? We never did so. We never offered to Russia a place that would be satisfying for Russia and useful for Europe. We were never able to come up with the concept of such a place. How can we possibly accommodate Russia into European architecture? We were not able to do that for good reason, because we Europeans don't have a common view of Russia. We don't have a common policy on Russia. And this is what we have to do first and foremost. Then we have to come up with a common view. Then we have to offer that we have to propose to Russia. And this way we will strengthen enormously those politicians in Russia who would like to have or have European agendas, and all those who would be propagating modernization and convincing Russians, electorate, that it should follow that way. Otherwise, we're just letting them do it alone, and it's always good to have some friends helping you in every task in your life.
Thank you very much. It sounded as if it was an excellent conclusion of the Russian topic. But I would like to, Kadri showed up interest to add something into it. So Kadri, three sentences?
I feel tempted to argue with what was just said. Actually, I think the West has been welcoming towards Russians, and Russians have been invited to join many Western organizations, be it Council of Europe or G8, and they have accepted without having qualified. hoping that, you know, this goodwill makes Russia to improve its behavior and we will qualify at a later date. And that's why I think, I mean, invitation to NATO was not extended because, I mean, it's dangerous to make this thing real, because then you have countries who say that, okay, they can qualify later, let's accept them, kind of different standards, so-called, we used to call it rubber rulers, you know, that there are one set of standards to countries like Estonia and then another for Russia, and with really serious security organizations such as NATO, I think these experiments would have been premature, although otherwise I accept that kind of prospect of joining Western organizations should be kept open for Russia, and yeah, we should make it clear that Russia, if it qualifies and if it wants, will be welcome. But so far I think our ability to influence Russia's domestic development is really small. But the best way to do it is lead by example and practice what you preach. When we start believing in Western standards, when we start believing in democracy again, because right now they don't believe in democracy. They think it's pretense everywhere. It functions similarly with Russia. But if we remain true to our own principles, they will notice it sooner or later. And if we are united in our position and show some resolve, then I think Russia will take us much more seriously and be much less adversarial than many think.
Thank you very much. And with this note, I'd like to conclude this this panel. As we can see, it would not be an easy task to reunite the West around the notion of unity of the West, taking as a point of departure Russia, the point of the reference Russia. There are very divergent views what's going on there and how Russia is going to cooperate with the West, and whether we can agree on the terms, how we are going to develop the relations with this very important country, which definitely deserves our attention and deserves our response to its interest somehow. Russia is still the country which may be perceived as a peripheral power in Europe. Well, with this unfinished business, I would like to conclude and pass the floor to Janusz.
Okay. Thank you, Sławek. Thank you to our panelists. And thank you all for coming and for staying. Very important. I don't have any grand conclusions. I just have one closing thought which occurred to me during the course of this discussion. It's not about Russia. I've written too much about Russia already. We keep hearing the term reassurance in terms of the American Central East European relationship, in terms of the security guarantees, the U.S. connection, and so forth. I personally think the term should be discarded. It's very paternalistic or maternalistic, and it assumes some sort of parent-child relationship. We even heard this from Phil Gordon, that they need reassurance, therefore we will reassure. I think this needs to be avoided. The Central Europeans are not children. They should not behave as such, and they should not be treated as such. Instead, I would urge us to talk about some future-oriented reinvigoration of the relationship. I will not use the term reset either, but reinvigorating the relationship. But to do that, we need a common agenda, and we need some overlapping priorities, overlapping policies. And what I envisage our cooperation with PISM is that we can begin to develop such an agenda, or recommendations for such an agenda, for the second decade of the 21st century. There needs to be a target, a time frame, and that will help us, I think, come up with some good ideas. And thank you all. One last comment, actually. The conference was made possible not so much by us, but by all the staff who worked so hard to make it possible. And I know Sławek is going to mention his people. Let me mention mine. Stacey, Mikel, Marton, Ilona, and Bestian, thank you very much for making it all possible.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. I would like to also to thank you, Janusz, for this excellent opportunity to organize this event in Washington, D.C. I think that definitely we should work out how we could come out with some conclusions which could be sent to our governments for consideration, how we could enhance transatlantic relations through this dialogue established by our institutions. I would like to thank very much our distinguished panelists for their extremely important for this initiative contribution. So thank you very much for being with us and for helping us to with this endeavor we have just initiated. Well, I would like to thank my people as well. Without them, it would be very difficult to manage. I would like to mention and thank Bartosz Wiśniewski, Katarzyna Kołakowska, Jacek Fox, Łukasz Kulesa, and I would like to thank very much the Polish Embassy in Washington, D.C., for helping us to arrange all these very difficult technicalities related with the transportation, with organization things. Thank you very much. So, ladies and gentlemen, I hope that we are going to see each other next year in this or other rooms, and we are going to continue this dialogue. Thank you very much.